Knowing Your Festival Rights, Part 1, www.own-it.org. Own It provides free intellectual property advice for London's creative businesses. Now, with the benefit of the Own It podcast series, anyone, no matter where they are, can gain an insight into intellectual property. If you're worried about protecting the event concept and production ideas for your festival, then this panel discussion will explode some of the myths surrounding festival design and management. In this podcast, leading experts discuss some of the often contentious issues of intellectual property that may affect the festival sector. It will advise on some of the best ways to copyright a concept, monitor brand usage, and get the right contracts in place. This free event took place at Shoreditch Town Hall in June 2007. The podcast is downloadable in two parts. This is part one.
Welcome to Knowing Your Festival Rights. The panel today, we're waiting for one more member who's been delayed in traffic and will be here shortly. The panel is going to look at different aspects of intellectual property rights and how it relates to festivals. It's a grey area, I think you could say. How does this work with us? There is law out there that will help us. And at the moment, we're in a boom time for festivals. And there's a boom time, and we're probably going to have a bust time in the near future. I think, and I'd be interested to hear what other people think, that it's probably going to be the best established festivals and those festivals with the best idea that will survive any bust period. And so ideas, the concept of a festival and what your festival consists of, is actually crucial to your potential survival in what might be a difficult future. What we've got here today is a panel of people who've all had quite close relationships with the festival sector, both as practitioners and as advisors. And I'm going to introduce them in reverse order. So last but not least is Yemisi Mabulu, who is working with CEDA as a trainer, but also is herself a practitioner. She runs the organization Hatch Events. Greg Jameson, who's on his way to us, is the CEO of Taste Newham. This is a new festival, newly established by Greg in Newham, celebrating Newham's diversity in food. And he has a personal story to tell about how he had to protect his own intellectual property right. But the first speaker is going to tell us what our legal rights are. As you know, where there's a hit, there's a writ, and you need a lawyer. And so Alex Papakuriakou is going to speak about the law as it relates to festivals of intellectual property rights. Alex works with the law firm Briffa, but he's also just confessed to me that he's, some years ago, been a DJ working at festivals. So he's seen it from both sides. Briffa also have a very interesting quote on their website, which is that there are no original ideas, which is attributed to Francis Bacon, but it doesn't say which one. Alex.
Okay. As Adam said, my name's Alex Papakiriakou, and I'm a solicitor at Briffa. The first question I think you need to ask when identifying what rights there are in a festival is, what actually is a festival? From my point of view, my view of a festival is that it's a collection of works that are displayed at an event. Now, it could be works being displayed as performances. It could be people bringing goods and design work to a festival. It could be screening of films. But a festival itself is a collection of these things, and it's these things being pulled into a single event. So with that in mind, it is quite difficult to see what rights exist in the event itself. How do you make money out of festivals? Like most things in life, I assume that nobody who's putting on a festival is doing it for the good of their health. Even if you do it with the most with the most charitable of ideas in mind, you're going to need to make money out of it. You're going to need to at least break even. So you need to have a look at ways of making money, ways of securing income streams into your festival. And that will usually be through admission, selling food and drink, potentially by having people pay money for you to let them sell food and drink at the festival. And merchandise and advertising are key ways of making money as well. Okay, going through the actual rights themselves, I'm going to split it into two. Basically, there's rights that help you as people who are organising festivals, and there's rights that you need to be aware of, and potentially licences that you have to have in place as well. One of the rights that are not noted on the slide are rights in confidential information. And before your festival is actually launched, that is actually going to be very much a key right. So if you have a copy of the presentation, it may be worth noting down confidential information as being one of the most important rights. The way confidential information works is basically it can work in two ways. The first way is to get people to sign confidentiality agreements. Confidentiality agreements are contracts between yourself and the person who signs it. And these contracts state that people will not disclose your ideas to third parties and will not go off and use them themselves to make money out of them. Getting a confidentiality agreement in place is the best way to protect your idea before you launch it to the public, because that way you have a written piece of paper which states that the person you've disclosed your idea to can't run off and make money out of it themselves. So if you can get people to sign confidentiality agreements, then you should do it by all means. However, it's not always possible. A lot of the time you'll be hoping to get people to sign confidentiality agreements and they'll simply refuse to sign them. The common law recognises confidential information in another way. It's not just confidentiality agreements. There is such a thing as common law confidentiality. And the way that works is slightly different. Firstly, you need to show that the information itself had a necessary quality of confidence, and that a business plan for a festival would normally meet that requirement. And the second thing is that the way the information is actually disclosed would have to imply that it was only disclosed subject to a duty of confidentiality. So, as a good example, there's quite a well-known case about the Ministry of Sound nightclub, where one of the guys who had the idea for it, he was at a dinner party, and he told the other guests about the idea, about having this large club in South London, that there would be so many rooms, the name, all kinds of information about the idea of actually the club. He told other guests at dinner party. So if you're telling people without having a meeting in place, without having a clear presentation, it's not likely that the information will be protected. In general, the best way to protect your work, to protect your ideas, is being confidential. If you can't get people to sign a confidentiality agreement, is to have a confidentiality notice on any paperwork that you have disclosing the idea. Confidentiality agreements are available from the OwnIt website to OwnIt members. So It's not too difficult to get a decent confidentiality agreement. But as I said, prior to actually launching the festival, that's where the money is. That's where you can protect your ideas. Once the festival's actually launched, you can protect it with a trademark. And you can also protect your income streams with your contracts with advertisers and people who go to the festival as well. Copyright is more likely to be something that you need to grapple with than something that's going to help you as organisers of festivals. And I'll touch briefly on that as well. Okay, so what is a trademark? It's basically something that tells you the origin of where you're getting things. So if you buy a can of Coke, you're buying a can of Coke. If you buy tickets for Glastonbury, they're tickets for Glastonbury. So it's just that sign that makes you know what you're getting. The right that a trademark give you are rights to stop other people using that trademark. So if any of you were thinking of launching a festival called the Cannes Film Festival, that's not really going to fly because that's already a registered trademark. As I said, the value of it is that people know what they're getting. If you buy a ticket for Glastonbury, you know you're buying a ticket for Glastonbury. So here's some examples of trademarks. These are well-known festivals. As I said, the value of this is that if you build up goodwill in your festival as festival organisers, then people are going to want to go to your festival. So in having registered rights in the name of the festival, people are going to know that you're the people organising it, and that if they buy tickets to your festival, that they'll be able to go to yours. Okay, so the question of why to register is basically what I just said. It protects the goodwill in your name. People know that they're buying tickets to your festival. Okay, so that's how you can protect your festival. It's not much, but that's what's available. It's, first of all, bringing your festival to market. It's having your new idea and making sure you get there before anyone else. And the second part of it is, once it's out there, making sure that people know it's your festival. And if they're buying tickets for your festival, what the name of those tickets are. Copyright potentially could protect some elements of a festival, but it's not usually going to be the case. If you're organising a festival, you're organising something for people to bring their work to. So people be putting on musical performances or dramatic performances, showing films. They're not copyright works that typically the organiser of the festival will own. So if there is something that you're organising yourself, if there is a copyright work that you're producing, if you're producing a short play or a piece of music, then that will be protected by copyright. But generally, it's going to be something that you have to secure the rights to rather than something that will protect you. Okay, so this is a brief list of the kinds of things that are protected by copyright. As you can see, it's quite a wide list. Films can be added to that as well, and music. Okay, so can you copyright protect the festival? As I said, the general rule is no, you can't. It's as simple as that. It's a selection of performances. It's a selection of copyright works. But the festival itself, the format of the festival itself, generally will not be protected. There may be some protection if there's a dramatic element in stage directions or in links, and also if there's artwork, if there's posters, they'll be protected by copyright. But the actual thing you're selling is the right to come and see a series of performances, and that in itself will not be protected by copyright. Okay, so what are the copyright issues that you're going to need to consider? Basically, it's clearance. In this short presentation, I focused it on clearances for music, but it applies across the board. If it's a film festival, you're going to have to make sure that you have the rights to show the films. If it's an art festival or a design festival, you have to make sure that the people give you permission to reproduce aspects of their design, photographs of their design in marketing material. But as I said, this is concentrating on music. Okay, so the licenses you need are, if you're going to have live performances, you're going to need a PRS license. If there's going to be DJs, you're also going to need a PPL license. If you're going to be selling musical recordings from the festival, you're going to need an MCPS license as well, and you're also going to need permission from the record companies. There's also something called performers' rights, which are very complicated, and although I've listed in the presentation, I'm only going to touch on. Basically, there's property and non-property rights. If you want to record any performance, or if you want to broadcast it, you're going to need permission. Usually, you're going to need permission both from the artist himself or herself and the record label as well. Okay. The other issues are about advertising and sponsorship. Most established festivals make a large chunk of their money from advertising. And with that in mind, a lot of people want to infiltrate those events, those festivals, to get their own brand on the festival. So if you imagine, if you're running the Carling weekend and everybody's walking around with a can of Welsh, it's not really doing too good for your Carling brand. People aren't seeing the Carling brand everywhere. They're seeing Welsh instead. There was a good example in the World Cup. The official beer was Budweiser. But in games involving the Dutch national team, there was a beer company called Bavaria, which is actually Dutch. And they were selling these orange lederhosen. And then everyone in the ground was wearing these orange lederhosen with the word Bavaria on them. Obviously, Budweiser wasn't too happy with that. And the only way to stop it was to actually force people who were buying the tickets and going into the grounds to take off the lederhosen and leave them outside. So often that's the kind of step that you need to take to make sure that there's no guerrilla marketing at your events. And often that means having terms and conditions for the people who attend the festival. Okay, so as I said, this has been a short presentation, and obviously it's quite a complex area. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to deal with them, but that's the presentation.
With BRIFA, in your daily life, what are the sort of issues that are coming forward from the festival sector that you're seeing? What are the common issues?
The issue that I actually dealt with today in relation to festivals was really just getting a trademark in place. So it's protecting the branding. On a wider scale, the legal issues, as set out in the presentation, are about rights clearance and making sure that there's no guerrilla marketing, making sure that you control the brands, the sponsorship, making sure that the sponsorship is the brand that's seen at the festival. And preventing guerrilla marketing as well is very important.
Because one of the messages I got from what you were saying is that there's rights, but there's also responsibilities that you have. And you touched on the PRS and MCPS and other people there. Could you just give us a brief idea about how do they work in this intellectual property world?
Sure. The PRS and MCPS are collecting agencies for music publishers. So if you're playing a musical work, or if somebody's performing a musical work at your festival, you need to have the appropriate licenses. The only time you'll need an MCPS license is if you're creating copies of a musical work. So if you're putting together a compilation CD of acts that are appearing at your festival, then you'll need an MCPS license. You'll also need permission from the record label to include those songs on the compilation CD. If, however, you're not putting together such a CD, if you're just having the act performing on stage, you'll need to have a PRS license in place. In addition to that, if you're having a DJ perform as well and he's performing works that have already been recorded, you'll need a PPL license in addition to the PRS license that you'll be using for the live act.
And these organisations work as a kind of collection agency for the artist. One way the artist gets some money for their ideas.
The artist, or if they've licensed the rights to publishing companies or to record labels, that's how they make money from festivals.
Are there any more questions? I'll take some more questions.
If you're filming people singing someone else's song and you're videoing that and putting it on your website, do you still need permission from the record companies to show that?
You would need a PR, an MCPS license.
MCPS.
Okay. Because you're creating a copy of the underlying work. You're not copying the performance that the record label own rights in, but you're creating a copy of the actual underlying musical work. It's a similar principle if you make a recording of a cover version of somebody's song.
Yeah.
You need to square away the publishing rights in that song. So it will usually be sufficient to get an appropriate license from the MCPS. Not in all cases, though, because sometimes the publishing rights in songs are fragmented and owned by different publishers. So if you are going to do that and you're going to use a substantial part of a song, so if you're going to use a whole song, for example, you're going to have to do some clearance. And that could involve going to the record label or going to the publishers, as well as the MCPS.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
There's another lady here.
Hello. You mentioned a community trademark and a European trademark as well.
They're the same thing.
They're the same thing. I just wanted to know, if I went to the UK Intellectual Property Office, would I be able to look into that, or is it something that's on a different website or separate because it's in the EU?
You should be able to find some details of it on the UK IPO.gov.uk website. But if not, if you go to www.ohim.eu, OHIM, O-H-I-M, there'll be extensive details about the community trademark on there.
Right, well, I think save up your questions if you have some more intellectual property right questions to ask Alex, because I'd like to move on to Greg Jameson, who's with us. Greg is the founder of Taste Newham. He's also the managing director of, the London Restaurants Association.
London Restaurant Association and Restaurant Guides.
And he has a festival about to happen, in fact, next week.
It starts on Monday the 25th of June. It's called Taste Newham. It's an event that's going to be running over a month, and we've had issues, and we're running through a lot of things at the moment. Most of my time at the moment is dedicated to try and put this event together with the help of a variety of different people. I think a lot of things I'll be preferring today is for people to ask me more questions than for me to be running through and actually areas to talk about. Taste Newham was put together about a year ago, and it was geared towards an event to bring East London to life within the hospitality and catering sector. It was a concept I put together, and I, to be quite honest, looked into the copyright side prior to me releasing a lot of the information into the public domain. I found it was to decide the name prior was important for me, and I had to make sure I didn't infringe on other people. We had other people out there like Taste of London, which is an established event at the moment, so I had to make sure Taste Newham, or whatever name I wanted to use at the time, didn't infringe. So I decided to approach copyright specialists to assist us in that, and that's what they did. They gave us a lot of advice. They told me what not to do and what to do. And it made my process so much easier, because I'm not a lawyer. My goal is not the legal side of things, but I need advice. Well, I needed advice at that point prior to me actually making strategic decisions. They advised me what to do. They advised me on what they expected my designer to do and how to put together the design. So I came up with some ideas, and basically they told me what I could do and what I couldn't do. Very simple. It was really simple. It wasn't a lot of hard work. And they juggled it around, and they put in the application, and it moved on from there. So from that aspect, it wasn't a lot of hard work from the side of looking at the legal aspect. It was more of a case where the proliferation of your information within a public domain. It's a case where I think it's important, and I feel that you can copyright the name, but you cannot really copyright an event. Or a festival, from what I understand. It's more of a name that you can copyright, but not the actual event. So there are a lot of people that will come to your event and maybe see things that you do, and maybe will copy or emulate what you're doing. So I think from festivals, as opposed to an actual product that you produce, in my eyes, it's something that you can't really hide, you know. But you can protect the fact that you can design a concept. I would speak to legal advice first, get legal advice first, and then take it forward from there. And any questions? Was the main what?
Complications. What were the main complications?
On the name, basically, I went for some funky names, some names slightly different from slightly too close to other people. So I was going for things like, I wanted to go for the Olympic name. So I went and bought the domain. So I bought all these domains that were linked to Olympic Village, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my copyright guy just stepped back on me and told me, don't do that, or big men in black suits would come looking for me. and take my domains away from me. And I got scared, so I thought, no, I don't want that, do I? So basically, it was issues like that. It was more on the type of name and what I was allowed and not allowed to do by British or European law, I presume. So these were just things that they were able to help me on. So it was, I want this, or I want East London Food Festival, or so and so. And if it's too close to somebody else, they will naturally tell you not to use that name. They'll ask you maybe to reframe slightly, or to use a name that's slightly different, so it doesn't impinge on somebody else. So during your application, you know, it's not a case where it's rejected on the basis that it's too close to somebody else, or somebody else who's actually got a festival, or who had a festival running for the last couple of years.
End of part one. Visit www.own-it.org to download part two of Knowing Your Festival Rights and to read our disclaimer. Thanks for listening.